Hey there, it's Joshua. Just a quick note before we start the show. A lot of news has broken today and is still breaking. The Friday News Roundup, of course, was recorded earlier, so we discussed a lot of what's been happening, but not everything. So to stay up to date on the very latest, you should keep an ear out on your NPR member station or go online to npr.org. Thanks. This is 1A. Happy Friday. I'm Joshua Johnson in Washington. By this time next week, Robert Mueller's year-and-a-half-long investigation into how Russian interference influenced the election of President Trump could very well be over. The special counsel is reportedly expected to present his findings to the nation's newly appointed attorney general in the days to come. But then what? Who else will get to see the evidence of what the investigation uncovered? If anyone. We'll get some answers to those questions and talk about other stories that are sure to shape the days ahead. Joining us this week for the Friday News Roundup is Shauna Thomas, the Washington Bureau Chief for Vice News. Shauna, welcome back to the Roundup.
Thanks for having me back.
Naftali Ben-David is a political editor with the Washington Post. Naftali, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
And Inez Stepman is a senior policy analyst at the Independent Women's Forum and a senior contributor to The Federalist. Inez, thanks for making time for us.
Great to be here.
Let's start off with immigration. 16 states have sued President Trump over his national emergency declaration from last week. The lawsuit argues that because Congress oversees the country's budget, any attempt by the president to divert funds for a border wall is unconstitutional. Before we talk just about the case itself, Shauna Thomas, let me start with you. Talk about the states who are suing and the players that are kind of emerging as the primary opponents to the president in this.
So the lead sort of state attorney general on this case is Javier Becerra, former congressman of California. He has become pretty well known for suing the president already. I believe this is the either 46th or 47th lawsuit that the state of California has tried to sue the president over. And he's kind of made a name for himself with this, and everyone sort of expected him to lead. You also have the state of Virginia is part of this. The state of New Mexico is part of this. I think it shows there is a lot of opposition against the president, but it is not the only lawsuit, and it's not the only way groups are going to sue the president.
With regards to that opposition, House Speaker Nancy Pelosi sent a letter to her colleagues earlier this week and said that a resolution would be introduced today to terminate the national emergency. Naftali Ben-David, we've been learning more about the laws surrounding declarations of national emergencies by the president. So it seems like they have a legal leg to stand on. Whether or not politically it will survive is another question.
Absolutely. I mean, the law provides for Congress to terminate a state of emergency declared by the president if they choose to do so. I mean, this shows that I think Pelosi is cementing her position, if you will, as the perhaps primary political antagonist to President Trump, at least until the Democrats have a presidential nominee. And it's pretty clear that the House is going to pass this. Then it will have to be voted on by the Senate. It seems a lot less likely that the Senate will pass it. But even if they do, President Trump can and will veto it. So in that sense, it's more of a symbolic gesture, although it's a way to get on record for Democrats as opposing this, and maybe more to the point, to put some Republicans in a tough spot. Many of them were very critical of President Obama's use of executive power. Now they're going to have to decide whether they're going to apply similar standards or different standards to a declaration like this.
Inez Stepman, can we step back just a little bit in terms of the politics of all this, to the money, in terms of what's involved in this declaration, where the funds are being diverted from? I mean, has the president or has the administration, rather, been clear with the way they plan to make this emergency declaration fund the wall?
Sure. And there are multiple pots of money here. And actually, the president is going to go backwards from the sort of most legally firmed up reasoning back through the emergency declaration, which I think his administration recognizes is legally infirm to some degree. So there are multiple pots of money here. There's $2.5 billion from the Defense Department and $1.4 billion from appropriated by Congress for border barriers, although there are, you know, issues about where that can be spent. Also, there's $2.5 billion appropriated for narcotics, although that money doesn't actually exist exist as of yet. There is a fund. Congress has appropriated the $2.5 billion, but right now that money is in other parts of defense. So they're going to be moving money from other parts of the Pentagon over. And that's all before they touch the funds that would be under that Section 2808 and the National Declaration of Emergency. But I think there is a good argument here for what you referenced, Naftali, about executive power, the expansion of executive power. I think there's an interesting argument here to be had constitutionally. And then I also think that what you mentioned about the resolution. So when this law originally passed in 1976, it included the ability for Congress to then check the president's power by passing one of these resolutions. It wouldn't have had to go over the president's veto. It just required a majority vote. That was considered a congressional veto under a case called Chadha. And that part of the law was struck down, along with many other laws that Congress passed during that period. That portion of the law was struck down. So the intent of Congress here initially was pretty clearly not to give the president this much unchecked power. But then again, they never went back and officially amended it. So this is going to be a case about what the intent of Congress is. They've specifically considered funding this project. They decided not to. Whether that counts as intent or whether this vague statute from 1976 can be repurposed and that counts as congressional intent. So there'll be some interesting cases here.
I'm glad you brought that up, Inez, because that's exactly what I was going to ask you about, Shauna, is where this leaves us in the eyes of the law. It feels like, as Inez articulated, there is this fuzzy legal area about where this might end up. This is kind of virgin territory in terms of Congress and the presidency. And, you know, even Nancy Pelosi has, I believe, warned that, you know, a Democratic president could decide, well, I'm going to declare a national emergency over gun violence. And that could lead to some laws that could make strong supporters of the Second Amendment very nervous. So we're kind of walking, correct me if I'm wrong, but it feels like we're walking into new territory that people across the political spectrum are kind of nervous about treading into.
Oh, definitely. Depending on how some of these court cases go, you may create a whole other precedent that any other president could use. And there are definitely pools of people in the legal community that say, with respect to the president's power to declare a national emergency, that the judiciary system may be sort of wary of trying to check the president on that. But there are other ways to check the president legally. And sort of Inez brought up the military construction budget money that is part of what could be used because of the national emergency. And that pot of money is sort of fraught because it has not been appropriated to build a wall. We don't exactly know what projects they are going to sort of steal from to like create this money for the president. But as soon as we do know what projects those are, that will create more lawsuits because other states will be able to directly say, hey, we thought we were going to get this money to help rebuild this part of our military base. Now we're not. Maybe we will sue over that. But I think it's worth coming back to Naftali's point about the politics of this and the fact that the law, the 1976 law that Inez referenced, creates a situation where the House will vote to basically say, we don't like this, and forces the Senate to vote. So it forces House Republicans, some of which who had come out before this, like Mac Thornberry of the Armed Services Committee, and said the national emergency is not the right way to do this. It forces him, who has two huge military districts in his base, to say, am I going to give the president this money, or am I going to say this is the wrong way to go about it? And it forces senators, some of which will be in hard races in 2020, to also have to go on the record about it and create the chance for, you know, possible issues when in their elections and their races when ads come out that say, hey, this senator said the president could steal money from your military base in your state.
Also worth noting, Naftali, that the Democrats and Republicans kind of held their noses, put together something, and the president went for the national emergency anyway and even said, I don't have to do this in declaring the national emergency.
He did, and that's cited very high up in the lawsuit filed by the states that he made that comment as they try to make the case that this isn't an emergency. I mean, I think a central dynamic that's emerging from the Trump presidency is he pushes the envelope in some way. He does something that doesn't have a lot of precedent or uses a law in a way it hasn't been used before. Then he gets sued, usually by a group of Democratic-led states. And then the courts suddenly are in this position of having to decide something they don't like to decide and arguably aren't equipped to do it. I mean, the courts are being asked to decide, is this a real national emergency or not? And I don't think the people who put together this law ever envisioned that decision being made by judges or justices. And so the role of the courts in this whole thing has emerged in a new way, I think, during the Trump era.
Inez, I personally am convinced, and I don't know if you see this the same way, that President Trump will pretty much double and triple and quadruple down on this wall because it is one of his core promises to his constituency. This was one of those that he said, we're going to build it. Mexico's going to pay for it. This is going to happen. This is about keeping drugs out of the country. This is about making sure we have stronger borders and control who comes in. I just feel like this is one of those that the president's going to go to the mat on. But I wonder how you see it in terms of how far this may go.
Absolutely. I mean, I think he can and he should. I'd like to separate the substance of the issue from the National Declaration. I have deep reservations about that as a constitutional conservative. I think we've laid out some of the objections. But fundamentally, the way that we were talking about it, I don't know, it just kind of sort of occurred to me the way that we've been talking about this. We have reversed the role of Congress and the president. We're talking about what the president is going to do legislatively and in terms of appropriations. And we're talking about whether or not Congress is essentially going to veto it. That's flipped. That's not how we should be talking about this. And obviously, this is the culmination of a century of expansion of executive power. But I have deep reservations about that.
Before we move on, Shauna Thomas, there was one more point you wanted to make about these lawsuits regarding the president's emergency declaration, particularly the California piece of it.
Yeah, that part of the reason why California is the lead on so many of these lawsuits is that the district courts in California do tend to skew liberal, as does the Ninth Circuit that sort of governs them. And so there is an aspect of court shopping. And liberals as well as conservatives do it. There's a lot of cases that originate in the Texas courts because sometimes you have a more conservative justice there. California, you might have a more liberal set of justices. And so they're hoping that that can allow them to move forward or possibly get an injunction against the president's national emergency. But we have to see what the courts decide.
A U.S. Coast Guard lieutenant is under arrest for allegedly planning an act of domestic terror. Investigators say 49-year-old Christopher Hassan planned to kill journalists and Democratic politicians. They discovered opiates, anabolic steroids, 16 firearms, and about 1,000 rounds of ammunition in his apartment in Maryland. Prosecutors say Hassan visited white supremacist websites for more than 2 years, often on his computer at work. The motion for detention pending Hassan's trial begins by reading, quote, "The defendant intends to murder innocent civilians on a scale rarely seen in this country," unquote. That is just one of the many stories that caught our attention this week. Let's move on to a story out of Chicago that has had the entire country talking. It has to do with Jussie Smollett, an actor from the hit Fox television drama Empire. This week, he turned himself into the police after being charged with disorderly conduct. Police accuse him of staging a hate crime and filing a false police report. Chicago Police Superintendent Eddie Johnson gave a press conference yesterday.
I'm left hanging my head and asking why. Why would anyone, especially an African-American man, use the symbolism of a noose to make false accusations? How could someone look at the hatred and suffering associated with that symbol and see an opportunity to manipulate that symbol to further his own public profile?
That was Chicago Police Superintendent Eddie Johnson speaking yesterday. Naftali Ben-David, this story just keeps getting more and more compelling. At first, the story was that he had been attacked late one night by two men who were caught on security camera, that they beat him up, put a noose around his neck, poured something on him, said, "This is MAGA country," M-A-G-A, as in Make America Great Again. There was also a claim that somebody sent hateful notes and death threats to Fox in Chicago addressed to Jussie Smollett. And now this has kind of unraveled. The police case around this seems to have moved pretty quickly in terms of saying this did not happen in our city, and not only did this not happen, he made all this happen.
Yeah, and that press conference that we just heard a brief clip from was very unusual. I mean, often police press conferences are full of law enforcement jargon and they can be kind of unemotional. But there you could see the police commissioner of Chicago get pretty emotional about the whole thing and speak in really personal terms. And I think that's emblematic of the effect that this story is having on a lot of people. If it is true that this was fabricated, as police are now saying, then Jussie Smollett took advantage of a movement to believe people who have for too long not been believed and whose claims have been dismissed. And he sort of took advantage of that and turned it on its head. And I think it's one reason that we're seeing this reaction. And of course, the use of the noose imagery is so incredibly powerful and fraught in this country that to use that, particularly if he did to get a salary increase, as the police are saying, there's something incredibly difficult and troubling about that. And, you know, people are, of course, in various ways, you know, going back to the camps from which they originate. Conservatives are saying, you know, look, this shows how liberals are too quick to embrace narratives that fit into their worldview. I think a lot of liberals are very pained by this and afraid that it's going to make it harder for people to come forward in the future. And, you know, several Democratic presidential candidates came out fairly quickly to support Smollett, and now they're having to backtrack. So this has really roiled the country politically and socially in a way that we haven't seen in a while.
Yeah, you know, as that was kind of what I was going to get to you about, is the way that this has been playing out as a sort of national Rorschach test in a way, especially among conservatives who have said that they feel kind of put upon by the story because this imagery that is associated with President Trump was, according to Chicago police, used as a way to inflame passions and just kind of force people into their political corners just by the raw gut reaction that it caused.
Sure. And there's no doubt that in addition to making it more difficult for actual people who are victims of hate crimes to come out and tell their stories, Jussie Smollett smeared half the country, right? When he told this story, I think that he owes an apology to Trump supporters for smearing them in this kind of heinous crime that it appears, according to the Chicago police now, that he made up from a whole cloth and paid friends of his to do with a check, by the way, which is kind of the funny part of all of this. He might as well have just written in the subject line, you know,
for more money for my salary.
Yeah. But there's definitely a story here about media narratives, right? This story was picked up, even though there were people who were skeptical from the beginning just because of the facts that he had laid out, right? This is 2 o'clock in Chicago. Chicago is a very, very liberal city. 2 o'clock in the morning in Chicago, he still had his Subway sandwich at the end when he walks in onto camera, and people were asking, like, how did he manage to have all these horrible things happen to him and then hold on to his Subway sandwich? There were reasons to be skeptical, not to totally dismiss the story, but to be skeptical and to wait for more facts to come in from the very beginning. And yet this became a huge national story. And I think that really should prompt some soul searching on the part of media that replayed the story completely uncritically for the first 24, 48, 36 hours, because they saw what they wanted to see. And large degree.
We got some reaction from listeners about the way that the media played this story, including from Trisha, who's here in D.C. Trisha writes, "The Smollett case is getting far too much media attention at the cost of more important stories." Freedom to Be tweeted, "I think the Jussie Smollett case says quite a lot more about the Chicago Police Department at this point than it does Smollett. It is known that the CPD is racist. Why should we believe anything they claim?" Shauna, maybe that's the other side of this Rorschach test, is that, you know, these kinds of attacks do happen. We don't really know. We just don't have enough information to know if this attack is real or fake. But Chicago PD's, to say the least, got baggage.
Chicago PD definitely has baggage. Also, the city is in the middle of a mayoral election, which happens on Tuesday. So, and there are 21 candidates who are all still sort of dealing with the aftermath of Laquan McDonald and the Jason Van Dyke sentence. And so there is a lot going on in Chicago that isn't just about Smollett. And I hear your listener who says, hey, maybe you should be paying attention to something else other than this actor from Empire. I do think some of the media and a lot of politicians fell into something that one of our correspondents on Vice News Tonight last night called, like, this was an easy woke point situation where a politician can kind of retweet something about Mr. Smollett, say, isn't this terrible? What happened to him? And say, and then be on sort of like the right side of history when it comes to hate crimes, but not actually have to do anything else about hate crimes. And so if this leads to people, one, being more thoughtful about how they consider the news and how they consider what is happening in the world, then great. If it leads to a better conversation about actual hate crimes, then great. But because it's alleged that he lied about all this, we are actually going to probably move further away from a conversation about hate crimes that we should be having.
I should note, by the way, that WBEZ Chicago has been covering that mayoral race, as well as a number of other stories that perhaps might be a little bit more worthy to Chicagoans. So, you know, how you see the world kind of does, in a way, depend on where you look. But I do take the point in terms of media coverage. Also should note that the Associated Press is reporting just within the last few minutes that Jussie Smollett's character will be removed from the final two episodes of this season of Empire. That's according to the producers of the program. Again, the producers of Empire say that Jussie Smollett's character will be removed from the final two episodes of this season of the series on Fox. Shauna, you look like you wanted to jump back in.
I guess there's just a small part of me that's also like, okay, remove him. It seems he did something wrong. It's alleged. I'm going to be careful about the kind of language I use with that. But this is also the city that brought us R. Kelly. And he is still making huge sums of money. People are still going to his concerts. And we are not totally as up in arms about that situation as maybe we should be. And I just felt like I needed to say that.
Let me get to a few more of your comments on that, and then we'll keep going. Jason tweeted, "The comment made was that Smollett smeared half the country, but it's not accurate to say Trump supporters represent half the country." And Melvina tweeted, "While staging a fake hate crime is shameful and despicable, right-wing indignation is totally hypocritical and used for distraction from their nonstop offenses." Inez, since you were the one who made the comment about Trump supporters and half the country, let me give you a chance to respond to Jason.
Look, so Trump supporters, you can go into the popular vote and the Electoral College, but Trump was elected in this country. And I do think that it was to further this narrative, right? We can have a nuanced conversation about race in this country. We can talk about liberals and conservatives and how the difference in how they might see racial issues. Those are all fair game issues. But to, sort of further this very, very crude and very offensive to all parties narrative that, like, this country is full of people who are running around like pouring bleach on folks just because of their race or their sexuality, because they're Trump supporters, I think that's deeply offensive. And I stand by the remark that I think that he owes an apology to a large part of this country, to millions and millions of people who support President Trump, for furthering this narrative, as well as, of course, to, you know, the Chicago PD for wasting their time when they have many, many serious things to deal with. And frankly, to anybody who actually has experienced this kind of terrible crime, for cheapening that experience as well. I mean, there are a lot of people he owes apologies to.
It's so interesting, Naftali, what a Rorschach test this is. I mean, last night I was at an event at the Heritage Foundation about civil discourse, oddly enough, and had a wonderful time. Met a woman there who worked on the Trump campaign. She was very, very proud of having supported the president, still does, is 100% Make America Great Again. Lovely. Absolutely lovely. But this imagery has taken on so many different forms for so many different Americans. It really has become something of a Rorschach test. And I think regardless of what your view is of the president, I think that aspect is almost indisputable, right? Like, that's, if indeed he staged it, that's the heart of the staging, is that it's such an emotional, it prompts such an emotional reaction that's kind of at the heart of its effectiveness.
Absolutely. And the reason the whole thing was so resonant is that it's happening at this particular moment in our social and political life as a country. And it kind of inflamed all these emotions. I want to take a second, which is just to defend the press a little bit. When a major star comes out and gives an account of being attacked based on his race and sexual orientation, we have to report that. And who would have thought the guy was making it up? I mean, you know, we can talk now about, well, there were some holes in his account. Absolutely true. And they came out soon enough. But the idea that the press somehow jumped onto a narrative heedlessly, because we're all a bunch of liberals who are sort of, have antipathy toward President Trump, I just don't think is really fair to the media.
And you better believe that if we had not reported on what appeared to be a hate crime against a black gay actor in Chicago, that could have gotten ugly too. Let's move on to another big story that has been kind of the big story in DC for a long time, kind of a story that we are waiting to sort of end as soon as possible. CNN and The Washington Post reported this week that Robert Mueller's report on potential ties between the Trump campaign and the Kremlin could be released as early as next week. Naftali, I wonder what what they base that on. What makes us so sure that the Mueller team is close to releasing the report, especially because the Mueller team tends to be pretty well leak-proof. They're good at playing things close to the vest.
They are, and we should certainly note that it's for at least about a year that people have been saying the Mueller report is about to come out. So we should take it with a grain of salt. I wasn't directly involved with this story, but I do want to say that where these things tend to come from is lawyers around the case, whether it's defense lawyers or people representing subjects of the probe who feel that they're being given signals implicitly or explicitly that the thing is nearing its conclusion, as well as reading tea leaves that have to do with whether cases get assigned to other prosecutors and that sort of thing. But that said, you know, I think that at some point, all these people who are saying the report's about to come out will be right, and that could be pretty soon. And if that happens, it's going to throw it right into Congress's lap, I think. You know, many members of Congress have spent months, when they're asked about the Mueller report, saying, well, let's wait till he finishes his work, you know, and then we'll deal with it. And when that happens, people on both sides, but I think in some ways, House Democrats in particular are going to be faced with this question that it's a legal but also a political one about how to move forward on this. The other thing that's probably just worth saying is we don't know what this report's going to look like. I think people have in mind something like the Ken Starr report, this multi-volume tome.
Like a ream of paper, bam.
Yeah. Exactly, with all kinds of sordid details about everything that Ken Starr thought happened. I think all indications are that the Mueller report's going to be something very different, that it may be very brief, that it may be legalistic, that a lot of what he had to say he said through indictments and through court papers. And so we just don't know. We have to see. And by the way, one last point, which is whenever this happens, it doesn't mean that President Trump's legal troubles are over. There's all kinds of cases that are continuing to proceed in the Southern District of New York, also in Washington. So this will be the end of a very big phase, but it doesn't mean that it's the end of the legal challenges to President Trump.
Inez, I was going to ask you about the many variables that are involved in this report. You know, one of our listeners, Brian in Bartlett, New Hampshire, asked, first, how much of it will we actually get to see? Second, how can so many people who are or were so close to Trump be guilty and or suspect, and Trump be as innocent as a baby? Does the buck not stop with him? Inez, I think there are a lot of different variables about who will see it, what it'll include, how much detail it'll have, what will come of it. But if at least from the history thus far, as Naftali said, with the way indictments have come down, I think it's a safe bet that it'll be a fairly like incisive document. It's going to be pretty like just the facts. Here's what we know. Here's what we think needs to happen. The end. Thank you very much.
So the only thing that's actually required out of this report is that Mueller explain his charging decisions to the AG, right? And by that time, it'll be Bill Barr. That's really the basis of this report will be I charged this person because of this, these facts that led me to believe that this was a charge worth making. I did not charge this person because of these facts. And there's no necessary precedent that this is actually even going to be released to Congress, let alone to the public, right? But we know that if it gets released to Congress, chances are pieces of it, all the relevant pieces of it, will be leaked. But there's no requirement for them to do that unless Congress wants to use it to legislate. And they probably don't want. It's a hard argument for Democrats in Congress to make that they want to use this to legislate as opposed to, make public. Right. So it's not clear how much of this the public is ultimately going to see to begin with. Further, I mean, to the extent that we do see what's in here, I do think it's likely to be legalistic and dry, but it will be difficult, even though there are, as you mentioned, the other investigations, and I've long thought that Trump is in much more legal jeopardy about the Michael Cohen payments than he is to this Trump-Russia collusion narrative. But I still think it will be a big blow against Democrats if there isn't something really huge in this report, if it's more just a rehash of things that have been reported on in the past, if there's no big smoking gun in this report. I do think it'll be hard for Democrats and left-leaning folks in the media to recover from this Russia collusion narrative that they've been pushing for 2 years and blowing up into a huge deal if it's nothing more than the fact that Manafort is a scummy guy. Mm-hmm. I think that's going to be a blow to their narrative.
Before I come to Shauna, I just want to restate, you know, something that you just said, that there is no requirement for this report to be really made public at all. This report could go to the people who need to know it on a need-to-know basis. Bob Mueller could walk away, and that would be fine under the terms of the way that this was supposed to be done. We may never see this report, theoretically.
Yes. There's no required, like I said, what's required out of this report is that Mueller reports to the AG why he charged certain people and why he did not charge others. So this could be a totally internal and classified document.
Shauna?
And there's no requirement that the AG send the report to Congress. Now, what I've been told is that the AG will probably write a summary of what is in the report, and that will end up being sent to Congress, but he does not have to release it. Now, you could end up in a situation that if he doesn't, there will be such a public outcry and such a congressional outcry that they may try to sue over getting parts of the report or getting more of the report, and we'll see what happens with that. But it is one of the reasons why these, you know, the Washington Post and CNN and the people that I've talked to are saying this is wrapping up, also is sort of time to Rod Rosenstein. And Rod Rosenstein has said he's leaving the Justice Department in the middle of March. And the theory behind that is that this was going to be wrapped up before Rod Rosenstein was really willing to leave. And by this, I mean Mueller's specific part of this and a report that has to be delivered. But back to the other thing, the Southern District of New York has multiple cases that involve the Trump Organization. They have a cooperating person who is very close in the Trump Organization, Alan Weisselberg, who is there. I believe the title is Chief Financial Officer, who has been cooperating. Mm-hmm. Other things will go on. The New York Attorney General has cases that are pending. So it this isn't the end, but those things may actually be more troublesome for the president.
I want to keep going with the roundup because we still have a bunch of stories we need to get to, including a congressional race that remains unresolved. There's one congressional district in the country that remains without representation, and it's North Carolina's 9th congressional district. It was undecided after the midterms last year. They spent months investigating claims of ballot tampering in the race between the Democrat, Dan McCready, and the Republican, Mark Harris. The vote was thrown out by the state's Board of Elections after Harris admitted under oath that answers he gave about hiring a political operative to manipulate absentee ballots were not correct. Harris also said that his memory had been affected by an infection that caused two strokes. North Carolina's 9th runs southeast of Charlotte and south of Fayetteville, and now it's been ordered to hold a new election. Shauna Thomas, it's always something with North Carolina, it seems to be. But what is this? Like, in the context of North Carolina being North Carolina, what is this?
I mean, what this is it appears if you've especially watched the State Board of Elections footage, and they've been live streaming over the last 3 or 4 days, what their investigation into this apparently absentee ballot tampering scheme. Basically, it's election fraud is what they seem to be saying, which I think is worth stating that that's different than voter fraud. And this all comes in this package of, we have a lot of people who've been talking about voter fraud recently and that, you know, we really need to protect things. We need sort of stronger voter ID laws. This is one of those flashpoint issues between conservatives and liberals on how elections should be conducted. And then this case happens, and it seems that on the conservative side, they hired someone who basically tried to sway the election by tampering with absentee ballots, possibly throwing some ballots out, that kind of thing. And we shouldn't confuse it with the larger conversation about voter fraud, individual voters trying to defraud someone, and election fraud, which is an organization or someone who is trying to whole cloth defraud an election. There were not individual people who were doing something wrong here. This was a coordinated effort, at least according to the North Carolina Board of Elections, a coordinated effort to try to swing an election to a certain extent towards the Republican in the race.
So, Naftali, this appears, at least according to the Board of Elections, to have been an inside job. What's the next step in all this? How do they rectify this?
Well, they're going to have another election, and it's probably worth saying how incredibly unusual it is in American history that the House of Representatives refuses to seat an apparently elected member, and then the State Board of Elections finds that the whole election was so badly tainted as to be illegitimate. But there's also this amazing human component to it. This wasn't a trial, but it came off like some kind of a overwrought TV trial where the son of the candidate tearfully told a story that contradicted what his father was saying, and there was a whole drama, a family drama, as well as a political one. But the next step is for the state to set a new date for a new election. It's really a remarkable thing.
Let's talk a bit about the Supreme Court. Ruth Bader Ginsburg is back at work at the court this week. The 85-year-old underwent surgery for lung cancer in December. She's been recovering at home. She returned to the bench at a time when there is lots of news related to the law, On one hand, the documentary RBG about her is nominated for the Academy Award for Best Documentary Feature. Also, her colleague on the Supreme Court, Justice Clarence Thomas, called this week for the court to reconsider a landmark ruling from 1964. It's known as New York Times versus Sullivan. And let me not, hyperbole would not be fictional to say that this ruling is a very important ruling in the modern day First Amendment. It makes it difficult for public officials to sue for libel. Shauna Thomas, why is Clarence Thomas speaking out on this? Was he just kind of like spouting off? Is this something that could actually happen? Like, what does this mean?
Well, basically, he was speaking out on it because the Supreme Court, there had been a case that was appealed up to the Supreme Court that was between the woman who had accused Bill Cosby of rape, and the Supreme Court decided not to take it up, partially because of Times v. Sullivan. And Clarence Thomas basically said maybe we should reconsider who can sue for libel.
Naftali, what's at stake here? Is this the kind of thing that is actually in the pipeline? Is there a case to reconsider Times v. Sullivan, or is just this Clarence Thomas just saying, well, here's what I think?
I mean, he was taking advantage of a concurring opinion. In other words, he agreed with the outcome of the case, but he wanted to go on record saying this, and this is an argument conservatives have made in the past, that the First Amendment was never intended to protect newspapers and other media organizations so much from mistakes they make or misstatements that they publish regarding public officials. But I think one reason this resonated so much, because on this particular issue, I'm not sure there's a majority on the court to overturn New York Times v. Sullivan, but it raises the question of whether this newly constituted 5-member majority conservative Supreme Court is going to take a look at a series of established and longstanding precedents. And that's something that everybody's been kind of waiting anxiously to see. And that raises the question again.
It occurs to me, Inez, also that Clarence Thomas has had some history with the press in the past. I mean, just go back to his confirmation when Anita Hill was the story, and that was the source of a lot of press coverage. And he said that he basically said he refused to be the subject of what he called a high-tech lynching. So the relationship between Clarence Thomas and the press has always been a little bit fraught.
Right. And the New York Times has published more recently some articles about his wife as well that might increase that contentious relationship. But fundamentally, this is not a view out of, I was going to say left field, but you can call it right field. even when I was in law school several years ago, this was actively discussed in the Federalist Society, others. I mean, the interaction between having a broad First Amendment and libel law for publishing, protection for publishing actually false and defamatory things about a person is not as clear cut as we've moved on in the Sullivan era, and everyone has sort of, at least in the mainstream legal community, has sort of accepted Sullivan. But there have always been objections. And if you go back to the founding of the country, this is definitely not what the founders imagined. There was much more robust libel law and protection from defamation in the founding of the country. And that was not seen as inconsistent with the First Amendment. So this is not unusual for Clarence Thomas to go all the way back to the original understanding of the First Amendment or any part of the Constitution and to place less weight on stare decisis, to place less weight on even landmark Supreme Court decisions that are more recent if he thinks that they were incorrectly decided on the basis of original meaning. And so I think this is kind of, it's funny that this story took off the way it is. In my view, Clarence Thomas writes things like this all the time, but perhaps because it is about the press, it took off in
also
the
related
press.
To Bill Cosby.
Right.
Also
right.
Brings
so,
it up a yeah. certain
so
level
So there's a
too.
Whole lot of yeah. other fuel on this fire for sure. Let's look ahead to another big race that everybody is looking forward to, and a familiar voice has entered.
Hi, I'm Bernie Sanders. I'm running for president, and I'm asking you today to be part of an unprecedented grassroots campaign of 1 million active volunteers in every state in our country.
That's Vermont Independent Senator Bernie Sanders, a presidential candidate in 2016, now in the race for 2020. Shauna, this has been an interesting kind of, Bernie Sanders was an interesting case, of course, in the 2016 election. He already kind of prompted some changes in the Democratic Party in terms of the way that superdelegates are dealt with. Some Democrats who are in the race have called for him not to be considered a Democrat because he's an independent, the whole Democratic Socialist label. What does his run kind of mean at this moment? Are people worried about Bernie Sanders jumping in?
I'm not sure worried. I mean, at this point, I think people are a little bit worried that there are so many people jumping into the Democratic side of this race. But I think the thing for Bernie Sanders that is interesting is that in 2016, he was providing a like much more progressive liberal counterpoint to Hillary Clinton and did quite well in the election in 2016 in the primary. And as you mentioned, has changed how the Democratic Party is actually going to choose its nominee. The thing is, what the messages he tested sort of in 2016 have been sort of co-opted and by some people expanded by a lot of the people in the race in 2020. And a lot of these people in this race who are saying some of the same things that Bernie Sanders said last time also are younger, more diverse, and female. And that is in the world we're living in right now, that there is some power in that. And so Bernie Sanders is now going to also have to fight to like keep his message on top when his message sounds a lot like some of the other messages, not all of them, not everybody in the race, but a lot of them, and also prove that he can in some ways be relevant. And with, you know, I'm sure someone is going to attack me as ageist, but part of this that factors in is that he is an older, in his 70s white male who I believe will be 78 or 79 if he were to become president. And that, and in comparison to a lot of the younger, different energy, more diverse people who are in this race, that might be harder for him to overcome because his message is so similar to other people's messages.
Yeah, Bernie Sanders is 77 now. His birthday's in September, so 70. So yeah, he'd be 79 if he won the presidency. Naftali, if I could ask you briefly about climate change, because the White House is taking another look at the issue of climate change as a national security threat. According to the Post, President Trump's staff is planning an executive order to assemble a panel to study it further. This despite the firm conclusions of the Pentagon and other intelligence agencies that climate change is indeed a national security threat. Now, a guy named William Happer is supposed to be leading this agency. What do we know about him or the people who are involved in this study?
Well, I think it's fair to describe him as a climate skeptic. He's talked about founding a carbon dioxide anti-defamation league, which gives you a sense of where he stands. He believes that the threat is wildly overblown. I think the reason the White House may see this as a particular threat is that it's one thing to push back against climate change when it's being discussed by liberals and environmentalists. It's another thing when it's leaders of the intelligence and military communities calling it a threat to U.S. national security. And that's why I think they feel compelled to push back against that, because politically it's a much tougher argument to counter.
By the way, before we go, we know that election cycles tend to bring us plenty of memes. We officially have our first meme of the 2020 election cycle, people. It's a college student named Hannah Kinney. She went viral after she was caught on camera accidentally walking through an event for presidential hopeful Kirsten Gillibrand, the senator from New York, at a restaurant in Iowa City. Gillibrand was speaking to a group of prospective voters when a young woman seemed to approach the senator. The audio is a little hard to hear, but here's what happened.
Back away from the bold ideas that the base and the grassroots care about.
Sorry, oh, sorry. I'm just trying to get some ranch.
Go ahead.
just going to get some ranch. Started calling a ranch girl online now. Kinney says it wasn't anything personal or political. Her Bible study group meets regularly at the restaurant. They often forget to include ranch in the order, and so it became her job to go fetch the condiment. So you gotta have what you gotta have for your Bible
well,
study.
Well, and in Iowa, it's gonna be hard to get your ranch because there are gonna be so many candidates in all of those restaurants.
Stock up.
So if
early.
You gotta get it, you gotta get it.
Shauna Thomas, the Washington Bureau Chief for Vice News. Thank you, Shauna.
Thank you.
Naftali Ben-David, Politics Editor with the Washington Post. Thanks, Naftali.
Thanks so much.
And Inez Stepman, Senior Policy Analyst with the Independent Women's Forum and a senior contributor to The Federalist. Inez, enjoy your weekend.
Thanks for having me.
1A's lead audio engineer is Jake Cherry, with technical help from Josephine Neonai. Our digital team is Gabrielle Healy and Catherine Fink. Our interns are Haley Blassengame and Jake Rudder. To learn more about them and the rest of our team, visit the1a.org/staff. We'll dive into the international section of the Friday News Roundup in just a moment.
Thank you.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from LegalZoom. Business owners can count on LegalZoom for legal advice and no surprises. Over 2 million business owners have trusted LegalZoom for LLCs, S-Corps, and DBAs. They've built a network of independent attorneys available in all 50 states, and LegalZoom provides complete transparency with upfront pricing and customer reviews to bring you peace of mind. More information is available at LegalZoom.com/NPR.
It's Oscar season, and we don't want you to show up on the red carpet unprepared. That's why Pop Culture Happy Hour is here to help you sort through the nominees and separate the best from the rest. Listen now, and we might even help you dominate your Oscars pool.
This is 1A. I'm Joshua Johnson. A number of governments are grappling with what to do with citizens who went to Syria to join up with the Islamic State, but now want to come home. This week, the U.S. and the U.K. rejected pleas from so-called ISIS brides who are trying to return. Also this week, a possible White House plan to help Saudi Arabia build nuclear power plants, the Vatican summit on sex abuse, a standoff in Venezuela, and more. Plenty to discuss this week on the Friday News Roundup. Joining us here in studio to review the top stories from around the world is Christian Carl, international op-ed editor at the opinion section of the Washington Post, and the author of Strange Rebels, 1979 and the Birth of the 21st Century. Christian, welcome back to the Roundup.
Thank you for having me.
Jennifer Williams is the foreign editor at Vox and the co-host of its foreign affairs podcast, Worldly. Jennifer, welcome back.
Thanks for being here.
And Abdurrahim Fukara is the Washington Bureau Chief at Al Jazeera. Abdurrahim, glad to have you with us.
Always good to be with you.
We begin with a story that has fascinated the whole world. Usually when ISIS, the so-called Islamic State, is in the news, we discuss the men that are fighting for it. This week, we've been discussing the women who are involved. Hoda Muthana is a woman from Alabama. She traveled to Syria when she was 20 to become a bride 4 years ago, and she was denied re-entry into the country. Here she is speaking on The Daily from the New York Times. She described her marriage experience to reporter Rukmini Kalamaki.
It was scary, but at the point, you just really wanted to leave that house. So you just, there was a woman literally marrying the first man that just came to them just to get out. Mm-hmm. You just write your preferences down, and then some guy comes with a list of men, and you can choose any of them, and then you just have a meeting with them. And if you like him, then you get married.
That's Hoda Muthana speaking to Rukmini Kalamaki on The Daily from the New York Times. In a tweet, President Trump wrote, quote, "I have instructed Secretary of State Mike Pompeo, and he fully agrees, not to allow Hoda Muthana back into the country," unquote. Let's break this apart in a few pieces, Jennifer Williams. First of all, is Hoda Muthana a citizen? Like, what's her citizenship status, or do we know?
Quickly, let me say thanks for having me. It turns out I forgot how to speak for
that
a second.
That is okay.
I wanted to get that in there. I said thanks for being, which is not English.
Happens to be every single week.
Perfect.
It's all right. Hoda Muthana, what is her citizenship status? Because she's being denied entry
right to
the country, but she's from Alabama, so technically she's American, but, like, what's the deal?
Right, so here's the deal. Her father was a Yemeni diplomat, and so the kind of question and the reason that the administration is saying that she's not a citizen is the question of whether a child, you know, normally a child born in the United States would be a U.S. citizen. The question is the issue of diplomats. So because they are technically under the jurisdiction of their home countries, because of the way, you know, diplomatic rules work, they're saying essentially, well, no, she's technically, you know, from her home country. She doesn't get citizenship because she was here as part of this family that was diplomats. So that's what they're saying. Her family is saying, no, this was, you know, after he had stepped down from being a diplomat. And so therefore, she was just here regularly. Therefore, she should have U.S. citizenship. You can't do this. And it's part of this fight that we're seeing kind of play out more broadly in other countries. And we'll get to, I think, some of those other cases. But the questions, you know, people are essentially trying to look at legal loopholes to keep people from coming back in. And so this seems to be another one of the ways that they could kind of, oh, look, we don't really have to let her in because there's this technicality because mm-hmm. she was here and her dad was a diplomat. So it seems that that's kind of what they're trying to do. Now, whether that will hold up, she should technically still get a challenge legally to be able to challenge that, and whether she should be able to do that in court or whether the administration will try to block that, that kind of is where we are now.
Abdurrahim, let's take a step back from her case just to this idea of these so-called ISIS brides. What do we know about the women who choose to travel halfway around the world, join up with the Islamic State, marry an ISIS fighter? Like, what do we know about them and what motivates them?
Well, we know quite a bit and we don't know enough. I mean, we know that there were several hundred women that joined ISIS as brides from the United States, from other parts of the Western world, namely Europe. And a lot of people explain that kind of appeal by highlighting the skills, the recruitment skills that ISIS had developed over time using the internet, obviously. But there must be a little bit more to that, because when you look at specific cases of these women who joined ISIS as brides, a lot of them have spoken of a certain degree of discontent or dissatisfaction with living in Western societies. And I think that's probably also a factor, although men and women who've joined ISIS from the United States or Europe have been heard to say that they were looking in general for a sense of belonging, not just because they live in Western society and ISIS is offering them something else. It's just an experiment trying to live or to find something that they feel is missing in their lives. And they end up joining ISIS, except that if you join ISIS, you're ISIS. And that's basically how you're treated. And Huda's case is no exception to this.
Christian Carl, it's worth noting, as we said, the U.S. is not the only country grappling with this. The U.K. also revoked the citizenship of Shamima Begum, who is 19 years old now. She left 4 years ago to join ISIS. Is there any sense of how the international community has been dealing with this? You've got the U.S. and U.K., two big countries who are very much involved in the fight against ISIS. Is there a coherent strategy for dealing with these so-called ISIS brides? And I use that term for lack of a better term, but maybe that's the best term for it. Is there a coherent strategy for dealing with these women? Are they still trying to figure out what to do? Like, where does the diplomatic piece of this stand?
Well, that's an excellent question. I mean, one of the fundamental principles involved here is a principle of international law that you should not make someone stateless, okay? That's a very well-enshrined principle of international law. I realize we don't always care about international law in the real world, but it is a principle. And under British law, you are not supposed to just strip someone of their citizenship and make them stateless. Most of the, you know, Britain has stripped citizenship from 120 people since 2016, mostly people involved in terrorism allegations. If I understand correctly, British law says that you can strip people of their citizenship if they are dual nationals, right? So then they don't become completely stateless. And not unlike the case with Ms. Muthana, the case with this British woman is also very, very complicated, because the British Home Secretary moved to strip her citizenship because the British kind of assumed that she had Bangladeshi citizenship, that she was a dual national. The Bangladeshis now deny that and say it's not true at all. One of the weirdest parts of the story is that she just had a baby, and the British are acknowledging that the baby has British citizenship, you know, because, well, you know, obviously babies are not guilty of joining ISIS. But it just kind of gives you a sense of how unbelievably complicated all these cases are. It is not as simple as it might seem on the face of things sometimes.
Jennifer, you wanted to jump back in.
Yeah, I just wanted to the point about calling them ISIS brides, I think it's an interesting question. I think, you know, one that the media has been having about how to refer to these women. And I think it actually speaks to kind of a way of thinking about who these women are, right? I think if you think of them as ISIS brides, that sometimes, you know, maybe in your head is like, oh, these mean ISIS fighters took these brides from like the local areas where they're fighting. That's not what these women are, right? These women that we're speaking about in particular traveled from their home countries in the West to join ISIS, right? To be part of this thing, knowing full well the violence, the brutality. I mean, that's part of the propaganda. So it's not like they were hoodwinked. Yes, the propaganda is very effective. Yes, it's very good saying we're building this, you know, we're building this glorious caliphate that is going to represent, you know, the true Islam. But they knew full well, at least, that the violence and the brutality was going on. It's also important to remember, on the other hand, though, that they were very young, right? When we're talking about these two women in particular, you know, Shamima was 15 when she left. I think Hoda was 20.
16, yeah.
Yeah.
She's 20, let's see. She traveled when she was 20.
Right.
She's 24 now.
Right. She was 20 when she left. These are young women, right? They're not children, but they're also not, you know, women in their 30s and 40s who have been through a lot of life experiences, right? So a lot of the ways to think about some of these women as well is that, okay, you know, how do we treat people who commit heinous crimes at those ages, right? Sometimes we try them as adults here in the United States because they do need to answer for their actions. But at the same time, we do take into account, you know, people tend to not have the best judgment around those ages. So it's really complicated in like a moral sense as well. It's like, yes, they did do this of their own accord, but at the same time, they might have also been idiot teenagers.
We got two comments to that effect in terms of what consequences they could face. Michael emailed, "I'm unsure of the legality or merits of her citizenship claim. I can say that as a veteran that served with many honorable Arabic-speaking Muslim immigrants in Iraq, some of whom gave their lives, she might be better off in Syria. She actively called for terrorist violence against U.S. civilians and supported the ISIS opposition to American forces in Syria. If she could come back, she should be charged with treason. She is a traitor and should be treated as such." And Brian writes, "I don't quite know how to feel about the ISIS brides. On the one hand, they are young and made a very foolish choice. On the other hand, they committed treasonous acts, and now that ISIS has lost, want us to welcome them back. Should they be forgiven or prosecuted? Worth remembering that in the United States, treason is a capital crime that can be punishable by death or life in prison. So it doesn't get any higher than treason. But do we have any sense of what could happen to them legally if they came back to the U.S.?
Well, I mean, first of all, I think we can all agree that whatever happens to them, these women have lost their place in the world because the project of the caliphate is gone, so they cannot continue living in the Middle East for the obvious reason that there's no state to protect them. The Kurds are against them. The Syrian regime is against them. The United States is against them. The Europeans are against them. And if they end up coming back to societies they originated from in Europe and the United States, even if they were allowed back in, they will never be accepted. So in that sense, they've lost their place in the world. Huda or her attorney is basically saying that she accepts that she had been indoctrinated by ISIS, and she wants to expiate for that, so to speak. She wants to come back to the United States. She wants to be allowed back to the United States, saying that's my country. And once I'm allowed, I do own up to the fact that I joined ISIS, a terrorist organization, which is considered by the United States as an enemy. I am willing to face the legal consequences, she's saying, according to her lawyer. I don't know how far her lawyer goes with that argument when it comes to capital punishment, but I am sure that she and others who are now willing to or want to come back to their original societies, I'm pretty certain that they do realize the full complexity of their legal situation.
And on top of that, there's a baby involved now. Like, there are children involved.
In the case of Begum, there's the issue of the baby. I just want to make one more point, which I think is very important. The saying that all politics are local. Well, in this case, all politics are immigration. Because the whole issue of nationality here in the United States started happening recently. And now we have President Trump saying that this is an enemy of the United States and therefore she should be stripped of her nationality. That argument, as we heard earlier in the show, it's been brewing in Europe for a much longer period of time. What do we do with the sons and daughters of families who emigrated to Europe and who no longer consider themselves in one way or another part of European society and European aspiration, mm-hmm. and who at some point join ISIS or Al-Qaeda. The drive from the European right has been very strong to actually strip these people of their nationality and even expel them back to the original countries their parents or their grandparents had come from to the West.
I know we got to move on in just a second. Let me get to one more quick comment and then a question, and then we'll keep moving. Ellen in Ann Arbor, Michigan tweeted, "Y'all keep saying that ISIS propaganda was incredibly effective, but only about 300 people traveled to them over several years. With the many millions of of citizens in this country who could have been persuaded, 300 doesn't meet the standard of effective. Christian, it may be worth, I take Ellen's point, it may be worth noting that it doesn't take that many people in order to do a tremendous amount of damage of the sort that ISIS was doing. And speaking of small numbers of people, it's worth noting also that the White House announced that 200 peacekeeping troops will be staying behind in Syria. Where does this leave us with regards to what's next for the U.S. in that region? Are we done, or is there still a little more work to do?
We are definitely not done in that region. I mean, if you'd like me to talk about that aspect, I wanted to say something else about the ISIS brides. But we are definitely not done in that region. The Trump administration says ISIS is defeated. I mean, they basically hung up the banner on the aircraft carrier and said mission accomplished. I think if you talk to anyone who really knows what's going on in the region, we don't really buy that. And in fact, one of Trump's top generals in charge of the effort recently said as much, right? The idea is not dead. And yes, perhaps the number of recruits from the United States was not that great, but people came to the Islamic State from all over the world. The Islamic State still has affiliates in Afghanistan and Nigeria, all kinds of places all over the world. The idea is not dead. We have perhaps defeated the institutions of the Islamic State in Syria, right, but there are still attacks going on in Iraq by ISIS fighters. It's not a done deal, and I think it's to be greeted that the Trump administration has had at least some second thoughts about completely withdrawing our presence from Syria.
I do want to shift gears to two stories about nukes, one on nuclear power and one on nuclear weapons, but you had a point you wanted to make about ISIS brides. Let's go ahead and let me let you make your point, and then we'll keep going.
Well, very quickly, by doing this, Trump is actually, by stripping this woman of her citizenship, Trump is actually playing into the hands of the Islamic State, because one of the main arguments of the Islamic State was Muslims aren't really citizens of these other countries. They're citizens of the Muslim world, of the Ummah, and they should naturally gravitate to the Islamic State. So by stripping people of these citizenship and dispersing them throughout the world, leaving them stateless in some cases, they are playing right into the Islamic State's hands.
Let's talk about two stories related to nukes. First, nuclear power plants. The House Oversight Committee is helmed by Democrat Elijah Cummings. It released a report and launched an investigation into Trump administration officials' efforts to pass along nuclear technology and build nuclear power plants in Saudi Arabia. Jennifer, can you give us the backstory on this? What is it exactly that the committee says the administration did, and how much of it is either illegal, immoral, unethical, unsafe?
Sure. So we knew actually from previous reports, Wall Street Journal had done a lot of really good reporting and other outlets on this. What the committee released was basically just gave us a lot more details about kind of the backstory about how this happened. So basically, this has to do with Mike Flynn, right? Disgraced former national security advisor who has since pleaded guilty in the Mueller investigation. Not the most ethical guy, I would go ahead and say, is probably safe to say. He was basically behind this project that he started. He kind of cooked this up with some retired former U.S. military generals at this company called IP3, IP3 International. It's International Peace, Prosperity, and another P. Whatever. They basically cooked up this plot, this scheme to get the Trump administration when, you know, they got into office. This started before Trump was even inaugurated. Was cooking up this plan to basically sell nuclear power to Saudi Arabia as part of this kind of broader economic kind of revitalization plan that they could sell. It was a way to essentially make money in a lot of money in the billions potentially if this kind of deal went through, to build around 40 nuclear power plants. What the Saudis get out of it is they have long been trying to diversify their economy and their energy sources away from oil because they know it's going to be running out and sooner rather than later. The problem is that, you know, Mike Flynn was dually working as, you know, part of the Trump transition and then as part of the actual Trump administration trying to push through this deal while he's also an advisor getting money from this IP3. So he is kind of right in the center. And then there's also another legal issue, or at least a procedural kind of issue, which is they kind of seem to have tried to go around Congress a little bit. Congress is supposed to sign off on any kind of deals like this for the obvious, or it seem obvious reason that, you know, you kind of need to make sure that the people you're selling nuclear technology to pinky swear to not use that to make nuclear bombs. I'm not sure if we trust Saudi Arabian pinky swears anymore. So Congress didn't really get a chance to weigh in. They tried to kind of go around and just rush this through. Now Congress, now that the Democrats have the House, they're stepping up and going, oh, hold on a second.
Right.
Whoa, hold your horses. Let's check this deal out and see what's going on.
I am never for the rest of my life going to get the idea of a Saudi Arabian pinky swear out of my mind.
It's a very fancy pinky swear.
It is indeed. There's a press conference. Mm-hmm. You'll see
royal.
Mohammed bin Salman and Mike Pompeo go, dink, pinky to pinky.
Falcons.
An orb.
Exactly. But I do take your, and by the way, I did look on the side that it's peace, power, as in power generation and prosperity.
There you go.
Do you know, Jennifer, if the Trump administration has responded to the release of this report, or is it still kind of is that yet to come forward?
Yeah, I think they're still trying to kind of figure out what they're going to do. Again, you know, as far as we know, this deal didn't like end when Mike Flynn got the boot, right? Like he's been out of the administration for a while, but it seems that this is still going on, right? Like Jared Kushner has been buddying up with Mohammed bin Salman over in Saudi Arabia. It seems that he may have been pushing this through. So it seems, as far as we can tell, this deal is still at least being considered by the Trump administration, which is why they're probably pretty hesitant to really say much right now. You know, Trump has been very open about why our relationship with the Saudis should continue, and it's simply monetary.
There's a really big deal that was way more than a pinky swear, but that was very important between the U.S. and Russia, and that is the INF, the Intermediate Range Nuclear Forces Treaty. The U.S. and Russia are no longer part of the INF treaty, and now there's more fear about the possibility of some kind of arms race between our country and Russia, akin to the Cold War. On Wednesday, Russian President Vladimir Putin made it clear that he found the possibility of the U.S. putting ground missiles in Europe unacceptable. Christian Carl, he basically, from what I gathered from it, said, you put weapons over here that may be pointing at us. We could put weapons over where we are that could be pointing right back at you. Is this bluster or is this a serious threat?
Well, there's an element of bluster to it because at the same time, he also stressed that he wants cooperation with the United States. He wants to talk with us about all sorts of issues. He wants to be taken seriously. The bottom line is that Putin wants to be treated as the leader of a superpower, right? I don't think he really has any intention of deploying a lot of these weapons on a large scale. The key thing is that he's really, it's a form of brinkmanship. He wants to remind us that he has these incredibly scary weapons, and we've got to take him seriously for that reason.
Has the U.S. or its European allies responded to this?
They have responded very well, actually, I'm not sure what the precise response has been. One of the striking things about this all happened during his State of the Nation speech. And it was a really striking performance because he described a whole series of new weapons. He did this last year at the same event. He described a whole new generation of Russian weapons, which are indeed very scary, mostly hypersonic weapons. He mentioned a new hypersonic cruise missile. What does hypersonic mean? It means that the missile can travel at many multiples of the speed of sound. This particular weapon, maybe 9 times the speed of sound. And the idea of that is that it can defeat any kind of missile defense that we might put up against it. So what he's telling us is that he's very, very serious about the United States pulling away from this treaty. He really wants us to think twice. And he's not afraid to raise the stakes to a very frightening level.
Abdurrahim, this feels kind of like a recurring theme with different characters. You've got Vladimir Putin and the U.S. in this kind of increasing brinksmanship. You've got North Korea and the U.S. and South Korea and Japan in their own little kind of situation of brinksmanship, where South Korea is like, okay, let's everybody calm down for everybody's sake. Are we really likely to find ourselves in the midst of another Cold War, or is this just kind of the way that diplomacy between strongman governments goes these days, where we got a bunch of big guns, okay, now that you've seen my big guns, now let's sit down and talk?
Obviously, you know, the a Cold War, if it happens now, is not going to exactly replicate the Cold War as we knew it back when it was happening. But there is definitely a sense of Cold War between Russia and the United States, for example. I mean, you talked about the Europeans earlier. That, you know, whether they say it or not, the Europeans have, especially since the Trump administration came into being, they've been feeling very jittery about Russian influence in Europe. And add to that the pronouncements of the Trump administration about NATO, for example, and you get a very, very nervous part of the Western world. Doesn't matter how you define the Cold War to them it does exist. And then you have situations like with North Korea and the sort of détente with the United States under President Trump. And you get a sense that the Europeans are feeling that the Trump administration's main concern is not really Russia. Its focus is elsewhere, leaving the Europeans themselves in the lurch. But what Putin said about, you know, targeting the United States and sites in the United States of weapons is probably for the Trump administration a reawakening of the fears of the Cold War with the Soviets.
And worth noting, of course, that for the Europeans and the South Koreans, this is not theoretical. You know, South Korea and North Korea have been having
it's
talks.
It's real.
This is a very real thing for them. And even in the UK, with the poisoning of Sergei Skripal, this is not just the kind of thing where it's the possibility of something happening. This is certainly not theoretical. Jennifer and then Christian before we break.
Yeah, just to get back to what Putin said, you know, I think a lot of this has to do, going back to the Cold War idea, I don't think you can talk about any of this without talking about John Bolton, the current National Security Advisor. He's an old school realist, right? He is someone who isn't a big fan of international agreements. He thinks, look, if you guys get to have these weapons, so should we. If China gets to have these ground-based, you know, weapons that they're very specifically, you know, targeted under the INF, you know, that's one of the reasons why the U.S. has wanted to pull out. It's like, well, this doesn't include China. It's just us and Russia. So China gets to have these. Why shouldn't we? And Bolton is kind of systematically dismantling a lot of these old Cold War arms control agreements. The concern there is that we do end up back in the kind of the Cold War arms race situation. And you can read Putin's statement in one way that he is essentially setting a red line to try to avoid that, mm-hmm. right? You cross this line, we're going to have problems. So don't cross that line in a way that is kind of a way to try to de-escalate.
Before we pause, Christian?
Very quick point. One thing we didn't mention was that the Trump administration decided to made its own decision to pull out of the Intermediate Nuclear Forces Treaty because the Russians were developing an intermediate missile that was prohibited under the treaty. And it's not the Trump administration that accused the Russians of doing that. It was the Obama administration that accused them. So it's important to keep that prehistory in mind.
Much more to discuss as we continue with the roundup, including the Vatican summit on sex abuse and what's been going on in Venezuela. Also, Beyonce and Jay-Z made a little bit of news this week overseas. We'll tell you about that when we come back. Stay close. I can't believe we made it. This is what we made. This is what we think for.
This message comes from NPR sponsor ADT. America's trusted home security company can help protect you against break-ins, fires, and carbon monoxide. 24/7 emergency response when you need it most. More at ADT.com.
How do we perceive our experience as humans? Who are we today and who could we be tomorrow? I'm Guy Raz. On the TED Radio Hour, we go on a journey through the big ideas that animate our world. Each week, it's the TED Radio Hour from NPR.
Back now to the Friday News Roundup. You know, we had an hour-long discussion about this earlier this week, but we did just want to mention, of course, the beginning of a historic four-day meeting at the Vatican. It's addressing the sexual abuse of children in the Catholic Church. Pope Francis has gathered about 190 leaders to the Holy See to discuss this. While taking questions from the press, Father Hans Solner of Germany said this.
Once you listen with open mind, open ears and open heart, you cannot remain as you are. You are transformed. Now, how do you force people to open their mind, their ears, and their heart? I think the meeting this morning I mean, the voices this morning and the meeting with a victim survivor this evening, who will be in the hall, is the way we need to go forward. Inviting bishops and religious superiors in every place.
That's Father Hans Zollner of Germany speaking yesterday. Again, we did an hour on this yesterday, but Abdurrahim, it'll be interesting to me, at least, to see how different Catholic leaders from different parts of the world view the Pope's approach to this scandal and also whatever the possible responses or solutions might be.
I mean, I'm sure that Catholic leaders everywhere in the West, Middle East, Africa, I'm sure they welcome the initiative and they welcome the openness with which the Pope has decided to deal with this very serious problem that obviously affects the Catholic Church everywhere. We have heard some rumblings in parts of the Catholic Church in some parts of the world that the Pope did know about this problem a long time ago and yet failed to actually take adequate measures to deal with it. What are these adequate measures that a Pope can take? It's not like he's going to hold this meeting for 4 days or a week or 2 weeks, and at the end of it, there will be a law. This is not going to produce a law. This is going to produce more focus on people's conscience within the Catholic Church to change their behavior. I mean, in a way, it's very difficult to legislate against something that has been happening in human nature for a very, very long time. But there are cases, or there's one particular case in particular, and that's the case of McCarrick. He's been defrocked, but the fact that he will continue to be a member of the Catholic Church does not preclude the possibility that at some point he will have to face up to his actions in a court of law.
Another big story we wanted to make sure that we camp out on for a while, because we've gotten a lot of comments from you about this, and that's what's going on in Venezuela. According to the Washington Post, one person is dead, a dozen more are injured, after Venezuelan soldiers opened fire on civilians at Venezuela's border with Brazil. Witnesses say the crowd was trying to keep a section of the border open so that opposition forces could bring thousands of pounds of humanitarian aid into the country. Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro has promised to send the aid back. His rival, the opposition leader Juan Guaido, has vowed to deliver it himself. Maduro says the aid is part of a broader power grab by Guaido and the United States. President Maduro has already closed the border between Venezuela and Colombia. He was trying to do the same with the border in Brazil this morning. This is kind of the latest, Jennifer, in the ongoing struggle between Nicolas Maduro and Juan Guaido. The election is widely viewed by Western nations as being rigged at best, a sham at worst. But right. Where does this sit in the context of that larger struggle?
Right. So, you know, Maduro's point that this is part of a kind of staged power grab is not wrong, right? So Guaido has been very open that this is, and the opposition in general has been open, that this kind of aid push is a very orchestrated attempt to kind of really force, and the main audience is the military, right? So the basic reason that Maduro is currently still in power, beyond the fact that he refuses to step down, is that he has the military on his side. They have not, in large numbers, we've had a few defections here and there, but they have not defected. And that is what basically everyone, the Trump administration, Guaido, even just regular people on the street, are trying to really get the military to turn. And if it turns, then Guaido, the idea is that he would be able to effectively have power. And part of this is really trying to convince the military to do that. So we saw there's this caravan of opposition people who are trying to go to the border to get this aid. The caravan was stopped by Maduro's forces, right? So they, you know, took tanks and trucks and even shipping containers and blocked the roads. They also happened to cause a major traffic jam. So you had people who weren't even part of this opposition caravan getting out of their cars and going up to soldiers and looking them directly in the eye and saying, look, you need to stop this, right? Like, we need this aid. We need this help, right? But you need to stop supporting Maduro and come to our side. And so it's really trying to force this crisis point to convince the military to defect and so that Guaido will have a chance to actually take over.
Speaking of who's taking sides, Christian, Russia has also gotten involved. It's a longtime ally of Nicolas Maduro. Russia says the plan to force the aid across the border is, in its words, a reckless pretext for a U.S. invasion. Any chance that the Kremlin, or America for that matter, could get more directly involved in this? One of our listeners, Virginia, emailed, is U.S. humanitarian aid a Trojan horse?
Well, the Russians have been very, very involved. They've been very, very vocal about their opposition to the attempts to undermine the Maduro government. There have been reports, it's still a bit controversial, but there have been reports that the Russians even sent in a bunch of mercenaries to help shore up the security of President Maduro. They've given the Venezuelans billions and billions of dollars worth of aid. So the Russians are very invested in the continuing, in the survival of the Maduro regime. And so it's very tempting to kind of see this in almost Cold War terms, right? That, you know, we have a socialist government, and, you know, the Trump administration is conservative, so they're opposing the socialist government, and the Russians are on the side of the socialist government. And you see a lot of people, especially in social media, kind of casting this in 1980s terms. And I find that very interesting because I think that's fundamentally wrong. This is not about, you know, Trump, the Trump administration says, you know, these are socialists, evil socialists. Well, yeah, you know, this started off as a kind of socialist experiment. But the point really should be this is a dictatorship now. It's an authoritarian government. You know, the United States is supporting, and many European countries and many Latin American countries are actually supporting Guaido's coalition, which is attempting to restore democracy in Venezuela. And then you hear a lot of leftists saying, well, this is a coup attempt and they're trying to undermine a good, you know, good socialist government. It's really about authoritarianism, right? And this is an extremely corrupt government, money laundering like crazy, stealing money like crazy, you know, sending drugs all over the world. So we got to get away a little bit from the old-fashioned way of thinking about this issue. It's a lot more complicated than that.
Well, and also an authoritarian government that is increasingly a failed state. I mean, sitting on an ocean of oil that it can't extract, refine, export, or profit from because the government above the oil is in such disarray that it can't really sustain a petroleum sector. Even beyond that, though, Abdelrahim, there are additional players that seem to be getting involved, like Richard Branson, the British billionaire, who says he wants to hold a kind of a Live Aid-style concert in Colombia near the Venezuelan border. President Maduro has responded by saying that he will hold his own concert on the other side of Branson's, on the Venezuelan side of the border. Is this... I wonder what your take is on the social piece of this, with other players getting involved. I mean, even President Trump held a rally in Miami this week in which he blamed socialism for Venezuela's woes.
The tyrannical socialist government nationalized private industries and took over private businesses. They engaged in massive wealth confiscation, shut down free markets, suppressed free speech, and set up a relentless propaganda machine, rigged elections, used the government to persecute their political opponents, and destroyed the impartial rule of law. In other words, the socialists have done in Venezuela all of the same things that socialists, communists, totalitarians have done everywhere that they've had a chance to rule.
That was President Trump speaking at a rally in Miami this week. So clearly, Abdelrahim, there are plenty of people making hay of this for various reasons. President Trump speaking in Miami, a community with a large Venezuelan population, a very large Cuban population, which clearly has incredibly strong feelings about socialist strongmen. You've got Richard Branson planning some Live Aid-style concert. This feels like the waters could get very muddy around this very quickly.
Absolutely. I mean, I just wanted to go back to the saying that all politics are local as far as what the president said about socialism. He was speaking in Miami, a swing state, We now on the Democratic Party side, we're hearing a lot of socialist voices, or at least that's how they're described. So he's talking to about Venezuela, but he's also talking to Americans in the prospect of 2020. He's also talking to Russia. I mean, we just talked about the Cold War. Russia has a, as Christian said earlier, Russia has a big stake in Venezuela, and they've found the opportunity to reinforce their influence, knowing that the Woodrow doctrine still stands. The United States will not tolerate any outside influence to greatly meddle in the Western Hemisphere, which it considers its zone of influence. Look, I just wanted quickly to say I've been to Venezuela, not recently, and Venezuela before Chavez, Maduro obviously inherited the mantle of Chavez, but Venezuela before Chavez was not paradise on earth either. There was a lot of bad things happening in Venezuela. And then Chavez took over, and he tried to woo the poor and empower them, sometimes in real terms, sometimes through trickery and gimmickry. The danger now is if Guaido actually ends up being the leader, if we have a new order in town in Caracas, I'm not sure to what extent he can actually keep the poor empowered to the extent that they were ever empowered under Chavez or Maduro, and yet introduce the kinds of reforms that he wants to introduce, which are seen by many poor Venezuelans as him basically batting for the middle classes and the rich. Whether that's true or not is a different argument.
There are a few other stories we'd like to get to, some from the world of culture, to lighten up a little bit before the end of the roundup. But before we do, Jennifer, you had one more point you wanted to make.
Yeah, and I just wanted to explain that, you know, the entire kind of fight about socialism, people tend to forget Juan Guaido's party, Juan Guaido, is a democratic socialist. And not just, you know, by name. If you read his party platform, it's pretty clearly democratic socialist, right? Like, it sounds like the things that somebody like a Bernie Sanders would be arguing for. And Socialist International, the, you know, huge international organization that represents socialist and democratic socialist parties across the world, has endorsed Juan Guaido and said that Maduro should step down. So it's a socialist and a socialist, which means if you're bashing socialism, which one? You know, and again, it goes to your point, Christian and Abdurrahim, that this is about, you know, totalitarian dictator, right? This is less about socialism qua socialism and more about how somebody has used socialism and twisted it corruptly and completely wrecked, destroyed the economy in the country of Venezuela.
Excellent point.
Few cultural stories we wanted to get to before our time is up. We mentioned Beyonce. She and Jay-Z added another accolade to their trophy cabinet this week. The couple was awarded Best International Group at the 2019 Brit Awards, and they accepted the honor via video.
Thank you so much to the Brit Awards for this incredible honor. You guys have always been so supportive. Everything is love. Thank you.
You're welcome.
There was also a little voice at the end of the video that we assume belonged to their first child, Blue Ivy. Beyonce and Jay-Z then turned to lovingly stare at a portrait of Meghan Markle, the Duchess of Sussex. The fashion world lost a luminary this week. Karl Lagerfeld, the acclaimed German fashion designer, died on Tuesday. He was believed to be 85 years old, though his birth date has been disputed. He was the creative director of Chanel since 1983 and Fendi since 1965, and he's widely thought to have basically defined luxury fashion, also known for his caricature-like public image and his outrageous statements, but his legacy is, to put it mildly, complicated. I know, Jennifer, you and I were joking about Lagerfeld during the break that you're maybe not so much of a Chanel gal, but he does have a fascinating and really a complicated legacy with some of the comments that he's made.
Yeah, I'm more of a Forever 21 kind of girl. Mm-hmm. You know, high fashion I usually get when it trickles down to about, you know, $10 a shirt. A lot less controversy on that side.
Right. One more thing we wanted to share about space science. We usually put a little space in our international roundup, and, you know, we've all been guilty of hiding things from one another. But the planet Neptune dished up a real surprise this week. It had been hiding a moon, meaning there are now 14 moons around Neptune. The new one is named Hippocamp. It's small. It's just over 21 miles across. Astronomer Mark Showalter discovered it by accident when he was investigating Neptune's rings using the Hubble Space Telescope's images. He thinks it could be a fragment from a larger neighboring moon, Proteus, broken off after a comet or an asteroid hit it some 4 billion years ago. We've only had one good look at Neptune, and that was back in 1989, 30 years ago, when the Voyager 2 spacecraft did a flyby. Abdurrahim Fukara is Washington Bureau Chief for Al Jazeera. Abdurrahim, thanks for talking to us.
Great to be with you.
Christian Carl, international op-ed editor at the opinion section of the Washington Post and the author of Strange Rebels, 1979 and the Birth of the 21st Century. Thanks, Christian.
Thank you.
And Jennifer Williams, foreign editor at Vox and co-host of its podcast, Worldly. Thanks, Jennifer.
Thank you.
1A senior team is Lindsay Foster Thomas, Danielle Knight, Gabe Bullard, and Denise Couture. This episode was edited by Miranda Fulmore. To learn more about them and the rest of our team, visit the1a.org/staff. I'm Joshua Johnson, and this is 1A.